go, 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 go for the finale for Murder.
Murder finale
for season one.
Well, yeah,
season one. So
we do have one more episode.
We do.
We have a Christmas episode.
We were talking about that recently. We're doing a Christmas superstition episode with
not
vodka.
Superstition. Christmas lore.
Christmas lore with vodka.
Because I still will tell my child that the Yule Cat is lurking.
The fact that you told your child the Yule Cat is lurking, and you bought him a special sleep shirt.
No, that's how you keep the Yule Cat away. If you don't get new clothes for Christmas, that means the Yule Cat will come find you and it will eat you. So in order to save away the Yule Cat, you get new clothes.
Okay, see, I have a tradition in my family of giving pajamas on Christmas Eve, but I didn't know that's where it stemmed from. That's creepy.
There's a few different ones. I believe there are a couple different ones. Most of them end up with the child being eaten, though, or killed.
Nice. I mean, not nice. I mean, wait, what?
How naughty was your child this year? You're like, But we'll talk more about those on my night on Christmas
Eve. And we have vodka because you forgot you had an advent calendar.
I did. I forgot I had an advent calendar. I opened like 10 days today. So I split the booze with my little mini bottles with my brother. And then I'm going to bring the rest out.
Nice.
But that will be our last one. And then we'll be on hiatus until the beginning, the first week of January.
Yep.
So probably not New Year's. We'll probably post the first one right after the first. So there'll be like one episode at the tail end of that week.
Yeah.
And then back on regular schedule, roughly. Or the first full week or whatever it is. I haven't looked at the calendar, so I don't know. I don't remember.
It changes on a Wednesday.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's weird. But tonight we are talking about Murder. Since it is the finale, I decided to give you guys kind of a double doozy. Tonight is the story of Carla Leanne Homolaka and Paul Bernardo. They are a Canadian serial killer couple.
Canada. We were just in Canada for my last episode.
We were. So we're going back to Canada.
With surgeries without anesthesia and...
Oh, gosh. So... Carla herself was tried for three murders, and her husband, Paul, we'll get into that.
That was a totally different matter.
That was a totally different matter. So she was born in 1970, May 4th, 1970.
Okay.
And she married Paul in 1991.
Okay.
Okay, so she had a little sister, things like that. I'm going to focus a little bit on Paul.
Okay, makes sense.
Yes, because Paul is a bit of a serial rapist as well as a killer.
I thought you were going to say serial killer, and I was like... I thought that that was your thing.
He's a serial killer and rapist.
Okay.
He was sentenced to life in prison and then was later declared a dangerous offender who was unlikely to ever be released.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was born Paul Kenneth Bernardo in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada in 1964. His father, Kenneth, fondled a young girl, and he was charged with child molestation in 75. He also sexually abused his daughter, Paul's sister. His mother, who was obviously really depressed because of her husband's abuse, actually withdrew from the family, and she actually lived in the basement of their house.
Wow.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, that's a whole nother level of...
Yeah. There was a book written by a man named Nick Prawn. It's called Lethal Marriage. And he does describe Paul Bernardo as being a happy child, always smiling, really cute. He had dimples, you know, sweet smile. Many of the mothers just want to pinch him on the cheeks whenever they saw him. He was very polite, well-mannered, doing well in school. He was a Boy Scout. But underneath all of this, he developed some really dark sexual fantasies.
Okay. Like, are we talking BDSM dark, or are we talking, like, dark web dark? Because, I mean, there's different levels.
Public humiliation of women and abuse. Hey, okay. Severe abuse.
Okay. Non-consensual public humiliation?
Yeah.
Okay, no, I have to clarify, because public humiliation is a totally legitimate...
It is.
...factor of the BDSM lifestyle.
It is.
Not always BDSM, but, I mean, it's a very legitimate lifestyle when it's fully consensual among adults.
So...
I sound like a sex therapist sometimes when I'm like...
Ew. He went to the University of Toronto in Scarborough in 1982, and he worked with Amway. He worked for Amway. So he would buy books and tapes from motivational get rich and famous experts. And then him and his friends would practice pickup techniques on the young women that they would meet in bars.
Okay.
I mean,
how did that go for him? Because that doesn't usually go very well.
Well, in October of 1987 is when he met Carla. And they were immediately sexually attracted to each other. And unlike the other women he knew, and this is coming from the other women, that he was very sadistic and abusive.
Okay.
In his sexual behavior. She, unlike the other women, Carla encouraged it.
Really?
Yes.
Why would you encourage?
I don't know. He was also really interested in 1991 with American Psycho. And he would actually...
Huge book that I could never get through.
Yeah, he would...
Also a movie.
He would actually read it like it was his Bible.
Really?
Yeah.
I could never get through that.
So, and that plays a very important part. So even if you've never read the book or, you know, seen the movie, most people kind of get the gist of it.
Yeah.
So Paul committed multiple sexual assaults, escalating in the viciousness of them when in and around Scarborough, which is where he lived.
Okay.
This is a warning. Some of these are going to, you know, we are going to obviously be talking about rape. And as further along as we get, it's going to get more and more graphic.
Also, we have a very big language thing that happens throughout all episodes.
Yeah, we do.
Bible binge for anyone who does not think they can handle this. Throw that out there because it's the most wholesome podcast that I listen to. Everything else is like murder and supernatural.
Yeah. So these are known instances that he participated in, I guess you could say. He was known for actually stalking his victims in the evening after they would get off their buses.
Okay.
So on May 4th of 1987, there was a rape of a 21-year-old Scarborough woman in front of her parents' house after Paul had followed her home. May 14th of 87, a rape of a 19-year-old woman in the backyard of her parents' house.
I'm noticing a theme with parents' houses.
July 17th, 1987, attempted rape of a young woman.
I apologize for the scraping noises. I felt like I was straddling the table, and it was super uncomfortable.
Even though he beat the victim fought back, and he eventually abandoned the attack completely.
I mean, that's not unheard of, though.
No. September 29th of 1987, the attempted rape of a 15-year-old girl. Paul Bernardo broke into the house and entered the victim's bedroom. He jumped on her back, put his hand over her mouth, threatened her with a knife, and bruised the side of her face and bit her ear.
Okay, look, when you nibble the ear, it is a rod in the zone. You do not fully bite. There's a nice little pressure threshold. Do not cross.
So, Paul left because the victim's mother entered the room and started screaming.
As one would.
Yeah, a man named Anthony Heinemeier, who was 19 years old at the time, was actually convicted of the sexual assault. In 1989, he received a 16-month prison sentence, and he wasn't exonerated until Paul Bernardo admitted to the crime in 2006.
Okay, look, my thing is, if I have served for a crime that I did not commit, I feel like I get a freebie. So whatever 18 months, I'm going on some really weird spree.
You would be breaking into Disney every night.
I would. Yeah, I 100% would. I would be, yeah.
Breaking. You would be taking things from Disney.
Actually, the workers, some of the workers got caught doing that anyways and selling the shit on eBay.
Oh, shit. That's a no-no.
That is a no-no. And also, I feel like I need to, like, look on eBay more often now. Because I miss that whole thing.
So that happened September 29th, 1987. Paul strikes again on December 16th of 1987 when he raped a 15-year-old girl. The next day, the Metropolitan Toronto Police issued a warning to all the women in the Scarborough area traveling alone at night, especially those who are riding buses.
I mean, that makes sense. They're trying to head it off because they don't know who is actually doing what.
Yeah. December 23rd of 87, he raped a 17-year-old girl with a knife that he used to threaten his victims. It's at this point that they now dub him the Scarborough Rapist.
Okay.
April 18th of 88, he attacked a 17-year-old girl. On May 25th of 1988, he was almost caught. There was a Metro Toronto investigator who was uniformed, staking out in a bus shelter. And the investigator noticed Paul hiding underneath a tree and pursued him on foot, but Paul escaped.
Okay.
So he was almost caught. That's on May 25th. It did not stop him. Because on May 30th, 5 days later, he rapes an 18-year-old woman in, and I'm going to butcher this name, Mississauga, Ontario, which is about 40 kilometers or 25 miles southwest of Scarborough.
Okay.
So he's kind of changed where he's at. On October 4th, there was an attempted rape in Scarborough. The victim did fight him off, but he did stab her twice to her thigh and her buttock, and it required 12 stitches.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're still not done. May 16th of 88, rape of an 18-year-old woman in the backyard of her parents' house.
He was a busy, busy boy.
Yes. On May 17th, the Metro Police actually form a task force to capture him. Because at this point, they're like, this is insane.
Yeah.
I,
too, would be feeling like this is insane.
Right? 2 days after Christmas of 88, December 27th, there was an attempted rape that ended when a neighbor chased Paul off.
Okay.
June 20th, another attempted rape. The young woman fought and the neighbors heard her screams. And so he actually ran with scratches all over his face.
Wow.
August 15th, the rape of a 22-year-old woman. He stalked her the night before outside of the window of her apartment and waited for her to get home that night.
Okay, that's just creepy.
November 21st, the rape of a 15-year-old girl that he saw in a bus shelter.
Aww.
December 22nd, 89, rape of a 19-year-old. May 26, 1990, rape of a 19-year-old. This survivor actually had a very vivid recollection of her attacker.
Okay.
And was able to help police create a computer composite portrait, which was released by the police 2 days later and published in Toronto and all the area newspapers.
Okay. So, I mean, now there's sort of a form of a picture out there.
Yes.
Although sometimes those composites do not look like the person whatsoever.
And in this case, it actually did look very much
That's good. I'm just saying, like, there are times where, because of shadows and things like that, like, stuff gets distorted. And
exactly.
You know what? When you're in, like, panic mode, you're not probably paying attention to detail.
So from May to September of 1990, police submitted more than 130 samples of DNA for testing for suspects. And then they received two reports that claim that the person that they're looking for is Paul.
Okay.
The first in June was actually filed by a bank employee. And the second one was actually from the wife of one of Paul's closest friends.
Okay.
She had told the detectives that he had been, quote unquote, called in on a previous rape investigation once in 1987, but he had never been interviewed.
Interesting. Why wasn't he interviewed?
I don't know. He also frequently talked about his sex life to his buddies and the wives and said that he liked rough sex, anal sex, and analingus.
You know what? That is a rarity. I'm just going to say I shouldn't say it. In my experience, that is a rarity. I know of one person. One person who's okay with that. Two people who would do it.
Wow. But because her phrasing and her conversation was very awkward and stilted, the detectives were kind of not knowing if they should take her seriously or not.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, though, because they're looking at it from an objective point of view.
Yeah, like, because, I mean, they're probably getting hundreds and hundreds of tips at this point.
I mean, and not all of them are going to lead to anything.
No, I mean, a majority of tips that get phoned into police hotlines, even now, I mean, the majority of them are not viable things. You know, you see something on the news and all of a sudden, oh, that's my best friend. That's my neighbor. Yeah. That's the guy across the street, you know.
Right.
I saw that guy walking into McDonald's. I mean, people get, you know, especially in this situation where there is a stalker who's raping young women, people are going to, and now you have a picture, they're going to be seeing that everywhere. They're going into fight or flight mode, really.
Right, because they're thinking, oh, it really could be.
Yeah, they, you know, it's kind of become that monster in the closet. Well, the monster's real.
Right.
We have a face, and so now you're seeing the monster in the closet everywhere, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But the police did some cross-checking, and they looked at several files, so they decided they wanted to interview Paul.
Okay.
So, November 20th of 1990, they brought Paul in. The interview lasted about 35 minutes. Paul voluntarily provided samples for forensic testing. When the detectives asked him why he thought he was being investigated for the rapes, he admitted that he resembled the composites.
I resemble.
Yes. So, according to detectives, he was far more credible than his friend's wife, who, with her awkward, staged way of speaking, they thought was just trying to collect on the reward. Uh-huh. So, Paul was actually released the very next day.
Of course.
Yes. It's... So, that... There's that. I mean, it's really kind of... Yeah. So, 1990, Paul and Carla have met, and they get married in 91. But they meet, you know, she's encouraging, you know, this behavior, you right. know. So Bernardo spent lots of time with Carla's family, and her family really liked him.
Okay.
Makes sense. He was engaged to Carla at this point, but he would frequently flirt with her younger sister, Cammy. Paul did not tell them that he'd lost his job as an accountant.
No, who admits to that?
Yeah, and at this time, he was also smuggling cigarettes across the Canadian-U.S. border.
Okay, look. Of all the things to smuggle, you pick cigarettes?
I mean, I would have taken, you know, inhalers, EpiPens.
Okay, the study in 2019, random facts, I know, 2019 for the goodie basket of drugs, it showed that the drugs were cheaper in Canada and almost like, I don't remember, it was a ridiculous difference in the price between Canada and the U.S. Like, you gotta smuggle, okay? The hard shit is gonna get you more money if you're bringing it down to the U.S. I mean, yeah, smuggle the cigarettes back, fine, but I'm just saying, you have missed a business opportunity.
You really have.
And then come out like,
okay, the fact that you have this information readily on your brain is...
Oh, because I wrote a term paper for something. I don't remember what it was. It was something dealing with drugs, and that popped up when I was doing it, the statistics of the price difference of drugs in different countries, and I did a whole little write-up on it. I mean, this is just a side effect of the psych thing in me. I'm sorry.
I mean, hey, I'm not saying anything about it.
A lot of my finals dealt with, even like in the general psych courses, a lot of my finals were like, this person's addicted to cocaine. How do we treat it? I'm not going to be a psychologist, but I'll tell you what the book says, because I'm not going to do that. That's not my job.
That's not your job?
Not at the moment, no. If insurances actually ever open up to letting us do our full potential, or people actually start studying things other than autism, someday it might be my job. But as of right now, the insurances restrict me to a very narrow point of view. So unless you have autism and also are taking crack cocaine, my ability to work with that demographic is very slim. There's going to be one person out there that's going to be like, I know someone. They just hear it now.
Probably. So, like I said, though, Paul and Carla met in 87. They were engaged. They actually got engaged Christmas Eve of 87.
Aww.
Yes. But
that's kind of cute.
But please remember that he continued to stalk underage and rape underage women.
Let me help for
2.5 years after he was engaged to Carla. And Carla was encouraging him to do this.
Okay, look, you're talking to a girl who literally got proposed to driving down the damn freeway.
Okay, are you going to encourage your fiance to rape young girls in Stockholm?
No, but what I'm saying is, let me enjoy the thought of someone proposing on Christmas Eve, which is somewhat romantic, and nobody's going to ever propose to me on Christmas Eve after being together for 3 years unofficially.
I feel like that's a big hint to someone.
Man.
But at the same time, do we want him listening to the podcast?
God, he's never going to listen to this. That's why I feel safe doing it. I feel like that would be I'm going to dump her now.
So one of Paul's complaints about Tammy, though, was she was not a virgin when they met.
Okay, so that also, though, is not an unheard of complaint. Just because I don't want someone listening to be like, I only want to date virgins. How does that make me psych? It doesn't. Like, that is a thing that some people do believe in. That
no, but that's what he would justify as why he was so mad. That's why he had to go rape young girls.
Okay, no, that doesn't lead to... You can be mad. You don't then take it a step further. You don't double down. We learned this last week. You don't double down.
No doubling down on things, okay? Or you end up with the coconut situation.
Exactly. Or you end up with the Reddit coconut scenario, which I'm hoping other people would have looked up because it is a great story.
Just type in Google Reddit coconut story.
It'll pop right up.
It's the first one. And there's like 5 different subreddits dedicated to it, and it's amazing.
It's a total culture thing.
But Carla was very devoted into pleasing Paul. She knew that he had become obsessive over her 15-year-old sister, Tammy. Tammy's just 15 at this point. To the point that he would actually look, he'd sit outside of her window and look into it. And then while she was sleeping, would enter her room and masturbate over her.
I get creeped out when tiny humans come into my room. Tiny human, because I have more than one. I'm counting the cats as human now. And I wake up and there are eyes staring at my face. Like, that freaks me out. Okay. Much less a grown-ass adult being in my room.
With his dick out.
Okay, that's how your dick gets, like, I was going to say bit. Because that probably would have, I snap at things. And in the dark, you probably would not move fast enough. Okay.
You're a fucking snapping turtle.
Well, I have a kid. I can't sleep with a knife anymore.
True.
That was my old defense.
Yeah. So, Carla actually broke the window blinds to give him more viewing. So, Carla is, like, encouraging this and even helping him at this point.
No, so that is your family. You cut the man's dick off and move along.
Mm-hmm. So, they knew that Tammy was a virgin. So, Carla's Christmas present to Paul in 1990 was going to be Tammy. They were going to force Tammy to be their quote-unquote surrogate virgin.
I'm sorry. Go in and get the damn operation and have your hymen stitched back if you want to have a surrogate virgin issue.
Yeah.
Because that is a real surgery.
Yeah. So, Tammy used to work at a veterinary clinic, Whole Thing. But she stole Whole Thing, which is an anesthesia from
Yes. I have heard of this anesthesia.
Yeah, she lost her job shortly thereafter.
Yeah, they do check those things.
Yes.
Even if they don't lock the cabinets very well sometimes, they do check those things.
Yes. Some reports report it as Whole Thumb. Some I see have said Valium.
Yeah, I think they're almost the same chemical makeup, I think.
It's like doggy Valium, basically.
Yeah.
Doggy Valium.
I mean, technically, I think you can use the same stuff because, like, because we used to fill, like, the cat prescriptions when I worked at the vet clinic at the human pharmacy, and then we just cut them up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can use, but you can also get the ones made for animals that are already in that lower dosage, and okay. So it makes it so you don't have to. For anesthesia, it's probably better to get, I think most get the dog version or the cat version.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can use human stuff. That's how Benadryl works.
Okay.
Random facts.
But, so Carla ends up spiking Tammy's food on the 23rd of December, 1990.
Oh.
The rest of the family went to bed, and Tammy was passed out. So they actually, they
applied. Do we need to do the warning here?
Yes, a little bit.
Forewarning, you may want to skip ahead a few moments if, you don't want the details, but you want to hear the end of the story.
Yes. So they covered her mouth with a cloth that was soaked in halothane.
Kind of like chloroform.
Yeah, and put it over Tammy's nose and mouth.
I was just throwing that out there for people because not everyone recognizes drug names.
Exactly. So then they forced themselves on Tammy. They record it.
So she's involved too. So like this is a little incestuous as well.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm just clarifying. It's not like she just watched.
No, she
it wasn't
involved.
A couple's
she was
fetish.
Involved in this.
Is it called a coupled fetish when it's the girl?
I'm not sure. They both took turns holding the camera while the other held the rag over her mouth and would rape her. sometime during that point, Tammy started choking on her own vomit, and she died.
Asphyxiation, yeah.
Yes.
That's what happens when you use anesthesia and you have food in your stomach. That's why they say not to eat.
And this is why...
If you can avoid it. Like, there are emergency situations where they will give you anesthesia even though you have recently eaten, but they may put a tube down your
throat. To clear it out. Yeah. But she died even though the halothane had burnt a hole in her cheek.
Ow!
And it burnt straight through.
Oh, ow. You can't pass that off as, like, she drank too much and died of this, you know.
Yeah.
Alcohol poisoning
and
when there's a fern.
They actually tried to revive her, and they called 911 after hiding all the evidence. They dressed Tammy. They moved her back into her bedroom. And
how did they think they were going to explain the burn?
I don't know.
I mean, I know that that's not, like... I mean, yes, call 911 and get help, but, like...
See, and this is actually... You know, even though, like, and this is what kind of blows my mind, is that the family noticed they were having very odd behaviors that night, vacuuming, washing laundry in the middle of the night, things like that. And despite the burn on her face, the regional multiplicity of Nigeria coroner and the...
Nigeria?
Is it Nigeria? That does not look right.
Or Niagara.
Niagara.
I'm like, Nigeria? Wait, we jumped
cotton. I can't read. I cannot read right now.
I was like, whoa, how rich are these people that they are vacationing for Christmas in another continent?
Yeah. I'm
She's
tired.
She's hanging her head in shame.
I am hanging my head in shame. And the family... both accepted Paul and Carla's versions of the events. And so the official cause of death for Tammy was declared accidental by choking on vomit after consumption of alcohol.
Well, it's not unusual for the family to accept their version of events. It really
is. How do they explain the chemical burn?
No, but that's not even relevant for the family, like,
yeah,
accepting it. There's
the
that denial
the
of
family.
The coroner's different.
Yeah.
But the family accepting it and going, no, that's...
Because you don't want to think that your one child is involved in the death of another.
Well, yeah, not just that, but it's not dissociation. There's an actual term for it, and it's basically that your current reality doesn't align with the reality you have in your head, and so when they're at conflict, you either accept your new reality, or you rationalize it to fit into the reality you already had. That's why it's the same mentality that they have in cult situations. When the leader's prophecy doesn't come true, people who are able to not have that mindset go, well, no, this is our new reality. You were wrong. Therefore, everything else you've said may be wrong. People who make it fit into their reality go, no, he's still right. He's still God. It's all good.
You're thinking of the Ant Hill kids, aren't you?
A little bit. It's a mentality. There's actually a term for it. And actually, I've experienced where I've had a friend go through that, where, like, I watched her trying to fit a new reality into her old reality. And I'm like, no, sweetheart, that... No.
Yeah.
Like, so,
and
this is, what's
this
going
is where
on.
It gets really, you know, a little bit worse here. About 3 weeks later, Paul and Carla made a video that they did find,
yeah,
and it was called The Fireside Chat. In the video, Carla was saying how much she enjoyed watching Paul with Tammy, and actually said she enjoyed watching him rape Tammy. Then she told him that she would help him rape even more women.
But is that just because she's trying to please him, or because she actually legitimately has this sort of fetish?
Yeah,
or
that,
fetish might not be the right word, but kink for it? Yeah. Well, because I can't call it a fetish, because I don't know if she has to have it in order,
yeah,
to orgasm. So I'm going to call it a kink. But does she actually have this kink, or is it more... she's trying to please him, and she's got a thing for pleasing him, therefore,
yeah,
she's going along with,
yeah,
it. Or did they never, like, determine?
I think that's something that they use, and that's how she got a plea deal.
Okay.
I think they did say that, you know, no, he was very abusive to her, so it kind of just kind of fell in line.
Okay, so less kink or pleasing, more abuse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like abuse, and then turning into the, this is my reality, I'm going to please you.
Yeah.
Kind of a,
well, some people have a thing for pleasing. So
yeah,
I mean,
she even said in the video that she would rape women every weekend if it pleased him because, quote, you are the king and you deserve it, end quote.
I'm having flashbacks to Nexium right now. The Nexium video is like, I'm fine. Everything's fine.
So she told him to go on upstairs and she had a surprise for him.
Oh, God.
They went up to Tammy's room where Carla...
Please tell me there's no corpse up there.
No.
Okay.
Carla
like,
put on Tammy's clothing and pretended to be her.
I'm sorry, she fit in the 15-year-old's clothing?
Yes, and then they had sex while Carla continued to pretend to be Tammy.
I'm sorry, I can't fit into my clothes from when I was 15.
I can't fit into my clothes from last year.
No, wait, I take that back. Actually, I do fit into my clothes from when I was 15. I really haven't changed much, but... But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a thing. And, like, those are my clothes, at least. Like, my body style. Like, it's totally different when somebody else. I can't wear something my cousin wore at 15.
Right? And so, just kind of to wrap this up, Carla and Paul, well, not really this
yeah, we're
one
doing
up.
Good.
Not this one up, but this Tammy in particular. They.
I was just looking at the time. I'm
yeah,
like, you're good. You're fine.
They put a picture in Tammy's coffin. And there's the picture. I'm going to show you that picture.
Of the two of them smiling?
Of the two of them smiling. So it is a beautiful picture of the two of them smiling. But...
Like, what the fuck?
The note that they wrote on there as well is even worse because they wrote the note saying that they would miss her and they were sorry that they couldn't protect her.
From themselves.
Basically.
They should have added from ourselves.
Right? So, shortly after Paul and Carla move out of her parents' house and move into a port dollhouse bungalow to allow her parents to grieve Tammy's loss.
Because what you want to do when you're grieving is be away from people.
Right?
That's guilt.
Right? So in the early morning of June 15th, 1991, Bernardo Paul was going through Burlington, which is halfway through Toronto and St. Catharines.
Okay.
He was trying to steal license plates. And there he came across a 14-year-old named Leslie Maffey. She had missed her curfew after attending a friend's wake and was locked out of her house.
Okay.
Paul left the car. He went up to Leslie saying that he wanted to break into the neighbor's house.
Because we just, you know, share
yeah,
that info with strangers.
14-year-old's like, yeah, you know, whatever, you know, got some cigarettes. So Paul's like, yeah, come on over here. Led her to her car. Got her in the car and blindfolded her. And then drove her to his house and then informed Carla that they had a visitor.
A visitor. That's how we phrase it? Okay.
They actually also videotaped themselves, again, torturing and abusing, Leslie while listening to Bob Marley and David Bowie.
Oh, David Bowie.
I know, right?
I love David Bowie.
Power of who? Who do you do?
I had such a thing for Jared. I have a thing for Jared.
Yeah, I will never get over Jared. Okay.
That is not past.
And those pants.
I used to say that saying to see if the Goblin King would come take my brother away.
Did you dance around his crib?
Sometimes. The crib was against a wall. It was very awkward to try and dance around the crib. Also, it was in my parents' room, which made it... had to make sure it was during the day, during nap time. Never worked. He's still there.
Is that why he hit you?
Probably. It's probably why I got hit with the fire truck on his first Christmas. He knew. He knew.
It was the spirit of Jareth embodying your brother and saying no.
No, child.
No. And so during the video, Paul is heard saying, "You're doing a good job, Leslie, a damned good job." And then the next two hours are going to determine what I do with you. Right now, you're scoring perfect.
That's super creepy. I'm sorry. Don't ever say that to me. Even during consensual sex, don't ever say those words to me. I will not be okay with it, and I will punch you.
Right. Another part of the tape played at the trial. And at this point, the assault has escalated. Leslie is crying out.
How are those jurors handling it? Jurors, not juros. And we're back. If you heard nice. That thudding, that was a brief interruption.
Small, brief potty break.
Not from us, though.
No, not from us.
From noises inside the home that freaked us out a little bit.
A little, yeah.
At least it was on your night, not my night.
Yeah, I think I would have not been moving if it was your night. So, at this point... the assault is escalated. You asked about the jurors. I would be feeling very wanting to be dismissed at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a handful of cases that I know have actually had to offer the jurors like psychological counseling right. because of how traumatic it can be.
Yeah.
But Leslie now is crying out in pain. She's begging Paul to stop. At this point, he is sodomizing her while her hands were bound together with twine.
Oh.
Later, you can hear Leslie telling Paul that her blindfold seemed to be slipping, which signaled that she could identify her attackers if she lived. The next day, Carla fed her a lethal dose of, again, the puppy Valium Helicon.
So she stole a lot.
Yes, she stole quite a bit. Carla said that Paul strangled Leslie. So they're giving like two different versions of... you know, who actually killed her.
Because someone wants a plea deal.
Right. They put Leslie's body in their basement. And then the day after that, the Homoloka family had dinner at the house.
Oh, what? Why?
Very sick individuals.
No, like, how did they know... Did they just, like, go over there and invite them over or something? Or did they know the family?
Yeah, they invited the family to come up. It's Carla's family.
No, but did they know the family before meeting Carla? Or was it just go meet the neighbors?
No, so the Homoloka family is Carla's family.
Right.
And Carla Paul have moved out, so gotcha. They had her family over.
I was thinking of the other family. Sorry. I was like, wait, what?
So after her parents and her remaining sister, Lori, leave, Paul and Carla decided that the best way to get rid of all the evidence would be to dismember Leslie and encase each part of her remains in cement.
Okay, I thought we were going on a completely different path there.
So Paul goes and buys a dozen bags of cement at a hardware store. And he keeps the receipts. And the receipts were used in trial. He also used his grandfather's circular saw to dismember Leslie. Paul and Carla made a number of trips with the cement to dump the cement blocks in Lake Gibson, which is about 11 miles or 18 kilometers south of Port Dollhouse, where they live. At least one of the blocks weighed about 200 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
And was beyond their ability to sink. So it actually lay up near the shore, where it was found later on June 29th of 1991 by a Michael Dochette and his son Michael Jr. while they were on a fishing trip. And her orthodontic appliance, I don't know if it was a retainer or anything like that, is what they used to identify her body.
Okay.
So in
you lost your place.
I did lose my place.
How did I know?
So when Carla was eventually, she was, you know, like I said, she was sentenced to manslaughter and she served her time and she got out on parole. So before she was released from prison, Paul was actually interviewed by police and his lawyer. According to the lawyer, Paul said that he had always intended to free the girls that him and Carla had kidnapped. But when Leslie's blindfold fell off,
plans changed.
Yeah, Carla was concerned that she would identify and report them. And then he changes his story and then says that Carla planned to murder Leslie by injecting an air bubble into her bloodstream, triggering an embolism.
Aww.
So, I mean, it's like, oh no, we always intended for these girls to live,
but my wife.
Yeah, you know, see, but my wife, you know, she's the one who did it.
Wow. Even all these centuries later, and it's still, well, you see, my wife. We've learned nothing.
Close to home?
I'm sorry. I have personal questions. Sorry. When I die, that is going to be one of the questions I have to ask Adam. Did you really think that was that excuse my wife was going to work? Did you really think? Do you know what you started? Do you know in the year 2019, men were still saying, but you see my wife. Okay. It became a thing.
You really want the answers to this.
Not in the belly button question. I gotta know.
Let me see your belly button.
Let me see. Do you have a belly button?
So, in April of 1992, it's after school hours, Paul and Carla drive through St. Catharines trying to find another victim. And even though there's still students going home, the streets are basically empty.
Well, yeah, because...
They were passing Holy Cross Secondary School, which was a Catholic high school in the city's north end, when they spotted a 15-year-old by the name of Kristen French walking to her house. They pulled into the parking lot of Grace Lutheran Church, and Carla gets out of the car. She's got a map, and she's pretending to need assistance.
Okay.
So when Kristen comes over and looks at the map, Paul attacks her from behind. He uses a knife and forces her into the front seat of the car. And Carla sat behind her, and to control her, she was pulling her hair. I know, we need moments. So, apparently, though, Kristen would take the same route home every day, and she was very, very dependable. because it would take her 15 minutes to get home and then take care of her dog. So, like, the second, you know, she didn't show up, her parents were like, no, something's wrong. They suspected there was something going on. So within 24 hours, Niagara Regional Police Service assembled a team and they searched Kristen's route that she would take every day. They found a lot of witnesses who had seen the abduction from different locations. So it gave police a very clear picture of what happened. Kristen's shoe was recovered from the parking lot, and it kind of underscored the seriousness of the abduction.
Right.
And this all takes place over Easter weekend.
Oh, Easter.
Easter. So again, they take more time. They did the same thing, raping and torturing, sodomizing her, forcing her to drink a lot of booze.
Oh.
And then Carla said that Paul strangled her for 7 minutes while she watched. Paul said that Carla beat her with a rubber mallet. She tried to escape, and that she was strangled with a noose around her neck, which was secured to a hope chest.
Aww.
Her nude body was discovered in a ditch in Burlington, which is about 45 minutes away from St. Catharines and a short distance away from the cemetery where their first victim, Leslie, was buried.
I just want to say, I think it's really strange that she had a hope chest.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, those kind of went out. I mean, I had one, but those really were not a thing anymore.
No. I mean, it is very, very terrifying.
Well, a hope chest isn't terrifying.
No, I mean, but everything that they're doing.
Yes.
I mean,
no,
that,
I was saying it's strange. Like, time period wise, like, not a lot of people still have hope chests.
Yeah. Eventually, police, you know, started questioning them in connection with the Scarborough rapist, which was Paul earlier, Tammy's death, and then the staking of other women before they kidnapped Chris and French.
Okay.
He and Carla took steps to actually change their name, legally change their last name to Teal, T-E-A-L-E, which is taken from the serial killer at the end of the 88 film Criminal Law.
Was that a hint?
Right. So Carla is now, you know, they get them set up, they get the DNA testing done. Carla is now saying she's, you know, been a battered woman,
right,
and things like that. They did end up trying them. Carla got a 12-year sentence in a plea deal for manslaughter, and she was she testified at Paul's trial. It was very highly criticized by a lot of people because Paul's first defense lawyer withheld videotapes for 17 months that were considered crucial evidence.
Yeah,
and they said that the prosecutors would never have agreed to the plea bargain if they had seen the tape.
Yeah, I'm sure they wouldn't have.
That lawyer was later acquitted of obstruction of justice, and he did face a disciplinary hearing about that in 2006.
Well, because that's not her lawyer.
Yeah. He continues to, you know, come out with new claims and things like that. Carla has served her time and has been released. She has changed her name since then. She's gotten married and has had three children.
And her name's public. It's public record.
Her name is very public record. Where did I have that? Do-do-do. Her new name is Leanne Teal, I think, is what she has. She goes by, possibly, is Leanne Teal. that's the only one you might find her under.
Yeah.
So, but that is the story of Paul and Carla, the double craziness there. And for the record, Carla actually, they both took a test for psychopathy. Carla scored a 4 and Paul scored a 38.
Holy shit.
And just for everyone who doesn't know, that's out of 40.
Yeah.
So
a 4 wouldn't put her on the scale at all. A 38.
A 38, however, is kind of high up.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's out of 40, sweetie. Yeah.
I mean.
So what is your take on the lovers of Paul and Carla?
I mean, it's definitely, it's a great follow-up for last week.
It really is,
but I mean, it just,
you know, the psychological portion of it, of like, okay, you know, it's like you're, and I can see a battered woman issue, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know, the prosecution probably would have never agreed to a plea deal to have her testify if they had seen videos.
Right, but it wasn't her lawyer.
Yeah.
So it's not like he did it intentionally to help her. That wasn't the case. He was trying to protect his client.
Yeah.
So you can't really hold him responsible for the fact that that influenced their decision with another criminal. Like,
yeah,
that's not his jurisdiction. Now, if his client had taken the plea deal, then yes, of course, he could have been held responsible. But
yeah.
Her lawyers didn't have the tapes either. So, I mean, they weren't aware.
Yeah. And
as far as we know.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people disagreed with it because they're like, well, you know, you're saying this.
Because they got the full story.
Yeah. They're like, you're saying this, but yet you did this. I don't think that fits anymore. You know, you can't claim that if you are seen and heard actively participating and talking about it and, you know, the joy that you're having on your face while doing this.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, she would have had to probably undergo more psychological testing and have a psychologist then say, yes, it is related to this mental condition or that mental condition, or no, it was definitely off her own devices. Because there are people, like I said, in cults that totally dissociate reality and distort it to fit what they think it should be.
Yeah.
And you get them out, though, and
I know some people that aren't.
Well, I'm using that because that's extreme.
Yeah.
You know, but even then, they go through reprogramming. They're able then to function as a normal human being.
Yeah. Which is why, you know, a lot of times when you hear about people, you know, rescuing their children from these cults, you know, I mean, they're talking technically about kidnapping a child from a cult because it's like, to them, they don't want
kidnapping because it's an abduction, because most of them are not minors.
Yes.
If they're minors, it's not kidnapping because technically, mommy and daddy still own their ass.
Some can be argued that they own your ass for life.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah.
So we kind of already touched on what I'm going to talk about next week. So I don't know if we really need to rehash that.
You know, but let's go with our fun facts.
So our first fun fact takes place in Indiana.
Oh, joy. We're in Indiana.
A little close to home.
A little bit.
Yeah. So there was a man by the name of William Clyde Gibson.
Okay.
Do you know this name?
No, but... Okay.
He became known as a serial killer after police found out that he killed his mother's best friend. The grossest part about the case, though, is that Gibson cut off her breasts and saved them in the glove compartment of his car.
Actually,
you're like, wait a minute.
I think I might know that person.
Do you want a picture?
I think I might know.
This is the picture, if that will trigger a memory.
Well, no, like, okay. I don't know him
personally. No, I didn't know if you read an article and you've seen the picture. Number 2 comes from Ohio.
Okay.
So Matthew Hoffman stalked a young girl and her family. He waited until the girl and her brother were home from school, went into the house, murdered the girl's mother, brother, and a family friend. He then kidnapped and locked her in the basement. He chopped up the bodies of the family members, hid them in a nature area north of town. The cops found the girl after a few days in his basement, tied up on the bed of leaves. It took days of interrogation before Hoffman finally admitted where he hid the bodies of the family members.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean...
Yeah.
There's also a story about Robert Leroy Anderson, who was convicted of kidnapping, raping, killing two women, whose bodies were never found. And actually, somebody had shared this story at one point because his mother was showing him her high school yearbook, and they were friends in high school. And in her yearbook, he had, like, in the yearbook photo or whatever, it had said, "I hope you don't die in D&D." So that is how he remembers the serial killer. It's yeah.
Wow.
I mean,
fun facts.
Yeah, I mean, fun serial killer facts.
Right?
I mean,
but next time we are talking about Christmas lore with vodka. So be sure to like us and follow us
on Twitter and Facebook.
Make sure to leave comments, send us messages. We love hearing them. Rate us on anything that you guys can rate us on.
And during the hiatus, I'm going to work on getting the webpage up.
Yes. Between that and recording new episodes, we shall have a load full.
Yes.
But, all right, so we will catch you guys next time.
Bye.